Now that I think about it, it's almost like what Drive to Survive did for Americans in Formula One a few years ago.
Yeah.
Dan Gurney did for Formula One in the late 60s. American is doing Formula One? Holy moly. People started to pay attention.
Look, if we aren't here for a reason, if we aren't taking the edge of the envelope and throwing it into next week, if we aren't concerned about the fact that this needs to be a show, and if we don't come at it from the standpoint of loving it and wanting it to live, it's going to die.
And Dan said, not too many years before he passed away, driving a racing car at the limit is hard, and it should look that way.
Yes. Yes.
We need to reduce the downforce.
Hi, I'm Sam. We make this show because we like it, but also because it keeps our young producer, Mike, off the street and away from a life of crime. If you want to help both of those things happen, your luck. We have this thing called Patreon. For a few bucks a month, you get to help support the show, but you also get some neat perks like monthly bonus episodes. The money we raise through Patreon helps keep this show on the air. If you like what you're getting here and want to help us keep doing it, that'd be great. If not, that's fine too. We like you anyway. You're here. We're glad. Join at patreon.com/notthecar. Back to the show. So we were talking before all this started about teams, right? And how people work together and how the weird alchemy of what happens when you get a bunch of humans in a room, in a space, on a project, and how they come together, how the culture is set from the top, right? Yep. And that works in racing, it works in creating things, it works in media, it works in offices, anything where people work together, it matters, right? So, and one of the things you were saying, Jeff, was, you know, that in racing, it's so critical because there's, not only is there stuff on the line, but, you know, you were talking earlier about prepping for next season and how a team puts things together with a car they've never seen to run a program with people they haven't run with, right?
Yep. Yep. And, I mean, it's like we were saying, any family, any business, any group of people have a culture, attitude kind of thing. And it's different across the board. I mean, you can go up and down the IMSA paddock and every one of those teams has a different culture, not necessarily bad or good, but different. And it's, I suppose it'd be like getting a group of families together and you can see the culture and it's hard to define or write it down or describe it, but you feel it immediately when you enter that group. And racing is exactly the same way, which is, you know, it's not the car. The culture is certainly not right. About the car. It right. Doesn't matter.
So on that note, that brings us to, we're doing one of our, what we call our other three episodes, where we have a host of rotating formats. And sometimes it's me, sometimes it's me and Jeff, sometimes it's me and Jeff and Ross, sometimes it's just me and Ross. But all of these formats are a little different and they all center around storytelling and pulling apart the things in motorsport that matter and the things in, you know, in car culture in general that matter. And this one today, we're going to do something we call How I Got Here. And How I Got Here is simple and complicated at the same time. It's basically, Jeff's laughing because he listened to me pull this apart before we taped and he's like, stop talking, Smith. I get it. Yeah.
I'm thinking about when you said simple and complicated, I'm like, yeah, like racing. Simple, complicated.
Right. But that's the core of anything interesting, right? You know, on the surface, it looks like there's not much happening, but anytime you pull one thread, you find that it's attached to 3,000 more threads behind the scene. So the focus of today's, so how I got here in general talks about, the point is to talk about the stuff that makes us who we are. What kicked our brains off when we were younger? What sparked some moment of revelation or passion or story, something that turned us into the, you know, quote unquote grown-ups that we become? And in the future, we'll do this with special guests. We might have somebody on to talk about, you know, how they became passionate about motorsport or how they learned X or Y or Z or just, you know, again, what made them who they are. But when it's the central group of hosts, when it's me and Ross and Jeff, it's, we're going to focus on specific people, specific moments, specific races, something from our past that's relevant to now. And in this case, the culture is a pretty good kickoff point because we're talking about one of the most famous people in motorsport. And most of all, a guy who was well known for being who he was and for building a shop and a team and a way of doing things because of who he was, where who he was impacted everything they did. And I mean, the name probably means a lot to a lot of people who love the space over a certain age, and under a certain age, you might not know who he is. But today we're going to talk about an American named Dan Gurney. Jeff, what's that name mean to you?
Ooh. You know, it's a term that a lot of people throw around, but hero. I mean, he was my guy. He was the guy that I wanted to be like, that I wanted to meet, that I wanted to know, that I idolized, that I, you know, anybody listening, probably has a person like that, whether it could be a family member, it could be a sports hero, it could be a sports star, it could be whoever, but he was my guy. I had a lot of other people in racing that I really admired and thought were great and would like to do things like them, but Dan was at the top of that list for me. And so, from a very young age, from when I mean, my first go-kart when I was even before that, when I had a go-kart, you know, they had those yard carts that you couldn't race on a track. You just drive them around your yard, basically. Had a Briggs and Stratton with some knobby tires on it, and you went bombing around. I had one of those when I was a kid. And the first number that I put on that, it wasn't a racing cart, but you wanted to make it look racy and stuff. So I put number 48 on it because that was Dan Gurney's number.
Yeah.
That's what I did. So that's what he means to me.
So that right there, that there are countless people who have some version of that story with Dan, because he was in so many ways an ideal, right? So just to give you the basics here. So born in 1931, dies in 2018. In between there, as a driver, as a team owner, as a kind of back of the napkin, off the cuff engineer, he's one of the most successful people to ever end up in international motorsport, much less American motorsport. As a driver, he won in Formula One, in sports car racing, in the Trans Am, in Indy cars, in the Can-Am, in NASCAR. He won Le Mans in a Ford GT40 for Ford, for the factory team with AJ Foyt. He drove, and then he drove and built cars. He built a team. He ran the team full time. And the dude was known. I call him a dude, and that seems rude because he was a gentleman and a guy, but also just kind of a apple pie, crew cut American human. There are a lot of people who come in and out of motorsport and make a dent. And something about that guy and the way he did things made a massive dent. And it's interesting, Jeff. Like, I'm curious when. So Gurney started racing in the early 50s, and he got out of the car. I think his last race was famously was a Trans Am race, right? With Plymouth in late 60s, early 70s. Forgive me, I don't remember. But yep,
probably.
So only 20 years in the cockpit, but you're probably at the right age that you first came to know the guy as a driver, right?
Right. Formula One.
So, yeah. Oh, that's the other thing, right? Oh God, I forgot the big piece. I forgot the piece right. So big, I've got a poster sitting next to my desk that I probably shouldn't pick up. It's framed. I keep trying to find a place on the wall for it. It's from in 1968, he won a Formula One race. It wasn't just any Formula One race. It was Spa. It was Spa at a time when Spa was public roads through rural Belgium. Basically, here's a two-lane through some farmland running past stone farmhouses, and you're going to go out there and do 160, 180 miles an hour in, you know, at the time the cars were essentially cigar-shaped fuel cells on treaded tires.
Yep.
So he wins, but he doesn't just win. He's the first American to date the only American to win a Formula One race in a car of his own design with his name on it. And his own design is a stretchy term, right? There, he had a team of people that helped him build it, but it was this massive moment. So when did it hit you and why? Like, as a driver, when did you wake up to the dude?
I think when I was really young, starting out in go-karts, he was racing Formula One, and it was that American thing. It was like, it's what, this is going to seem weird, but now that I think about it, it's almost like what Drive to Survive did for Americans in Formula One a few years ago.
Yeah.
Dan Gurney did for Formula One in the late 60s. You know, he brought the attention to it. American is doing Formula One? Holy moly. And people started to pay attention. And because it was a racing sport that, you know, it wasn't the Indy 500. And if it wasn't, who cared in America? But suddenly, an American, big old good-looking American movie star kind of guy, like almost like Steve McQueen, went to go Formula One racing. And people started paying attention to it. And so if you were involved in racing in any way as a young kid go-karting, Dan Gurney was like, yeah, we want Dan Gurney to win, right? And you would kind of root him on and wish him good luck and all of that kind of stuff. And so he started a fan club, and lots of people joined up the fan club. And that's how I did. We just signed up for the fan club, and my parents paid the $10 a year or whatever it was. And we got a newsletter after every race and a sticker and a patch for our jacket and All American Racers Eagle Club. And I was a fan. And that's how I started following them.
And I think it's worth noting, too, that at this point, right, so Drive to Survive is an anomaly in the history of Formula One in America, right? You know, up until the 90s, finding a TV broadcast of the sport in America was difficult. Hell, up until 10, 15 years ago, it was difficult. You know, 20 years ago, when I lived in Chicago, there was one bar that we knew of in town that would play it. And you had to, you know, it was all the way downtown, and there was nowhere else to watch it. And it was, you couldn't get it on TV unless you had a really expensive pay-per-view deal. But in the 60s and the 50s and the 70s, even into the 80s, so much of the sport over here, especially during the times when we didn't have a Grand Prix in America, when the circus did not stop in this country, the only way you knew about it was newspaper reports and car magazines. And you know, things like Road and Track would come out once a month, and you know, there'd be somebody's report. And that was kind of enough. But the notion that one person and that personality could transcend, you know, what amounts to a few thousand words on a piece of paper once a month, and you could get a glimpse of who this guy was and how he thought, that's a pretty powerful statement about, you know, just how strong his personality was, right? I mean,
right.
What kind of vibe did you get off of him? So, like, to give an illustration, imagine a 6'4" Californian, where every picture you see of him, he's smiling. Half the pictures from his early career, he's driving race cars in sneakers, you know, the equivalent of a Converse or Vans. And every picture of him smiling, he's grinning, and it's a big old grin. And the guy's quick, and he's massive. He's very, very tall and lanky, and race car drivers aren't tall. And just all this unlikely stuff. Like, what kind of picture did you get of him? What had that attitude?
Very similar to that. And he acted like it wasn't any big deal. Like, yeah, this is what I do. Yeah, I got this wreath around me and these two trophy girls on either side of me. And we were in victory lane and we won this race. And yep, okay, see you Monday morning at the shop and we'll be working on the cars for next week. I mean, it was like no big deal. He didn't want celebrity. He didn't. And maybe that's a lot of the appeal. He was just a regular guy. And it made me think, as a youngster, that maybe that was attainable because I was a regular guy. You know, when you look at some people, you're like, oh, I could never do that. He's something special. Dan was a regular guy doing special things. And it was like, wow, maybe I could do that too. I could be a race car driver, maybe, because he could do it. I'll just do what he does. I'll try to be like him, you know, and maybe it'll work out. And so that's kind of the way I glommed on to wanting to do things like him and wanting to be like him. And it was, you know, the things we don't know, or the things that I didn't know at the time that are even more amazing, is he was able to get big companies like Goodyear and Ford to back his efforts.
Yeah.
You know, and that was hard. It took a lot of money back then, relative, you know, a lot less than it takes now, but still relative to the economy. And it was Formula One to American team. I mean, you can say all you want about Haas these days. It's okay, it's an American team based in Europe. And I mean, this was based in Santa Ana, California. That's, and they had Anglo-American racers in England, which was a, like a shop to work out of in Europe. But everything was built. Len Terry designed the cars. They were built in Santa Ana. And it was a real American team with American power, American tires, American driver. And that was just cool.
So there's something at the core of what you were talking about there that, that has been bouncing around my head ever since we, you know, we decided on this topic a couple of days ago, and I was standing in the shower yesterday, just thinking about how people end up leaving a mark on who we are without people people that you don't get to meet without ever actually entering your orbit. And there's something about the culture of motorsport, something about the culture of racing in general, especially professional racing. It can seem so distant and so foreign and so grown up and adult and serious. Even in the 50s, when, you know, quote unquote professional motorsport was largely, you know, you could walk into the pits at Monza or Indianapolis and kind of looked like a bunch of guys from the neighborhood doing things with cars that kind of sort of in many ways had been built in sheds, right? Mm-hmm. And but it still seemed so unapproachable, and it always has seemed unapproachable. And there's a lot to be said for seeing somebody like you, or even just somebody who isn't like you, who seems welcoming in a picture, in video. And then when that person, you know, Gurney's record, everything the guy got into, he was quick. And everybody he worked with had good results on some level with him.
Yep.
And there was a, you know, he drove an F1 for Ferrari, for BRM, for Brabham. And I read a story a while back. He was sitting on the grid somewhere in Europe, looking around, surrounded by Lotuses and all kinds of other things that came out of, you know, Formula One was born in Europe, right? But there's this great quote where he's sitting in the car and he's looking around and he's just having this kind of like typical Gurney head scratching moment. And this embodies the guys, I keep calling him a dude, it's disrespectful, embodies the man's whole career, right? And he said, you know, he thought to himself, well, we've been into space, we invented Coca-Cola, we built the first airplane, and we helped win the war. How come we don't have a Formula One car? And there had been efforts before, right? You know, famously, in the late 50s, out of California, one particular team, Scarab, a guy named Lance Revenlow, tried to build Offie-powered, you know, Offenhauser, Indianapolis motor, basically, powered Formula One cars. It didn't quite land. But, you know, the fact that that was Dan in a nutshell, and his entire career is summed up, all of the things he was a part of, all the stuff he invented, all the stuff that just came out of that Santa Ana shop, was some moment of revelation where he looked around and said, well, why not? And, you know, somebody inevitably gave a reason why not. And for Dan, it was never good enough. The answer was just, well, hell, do it.
I'll just do it.
Yeah. And that's, what do you, like, how does that hit you as an engineer, right?
I mean, those were the days, I guess, those were the days when you could do that. You had to have the money.
Yeah.
And like I said, Ford and Goodyear backed him, and that's what kicked the whole thing off. Now he had the money, and I don't know, maybe he didn't know that you couldn't do that, so he just did it, you know. It's like I get the feeling that, and I've never talked to him about this specifically, but I get the feeling that he just, it wasn't like, oh, I wonder if I could do this. It's like, I have the money, I'm just gonna do it. It wasn't like, you know, it was kind of like, well, how hard can this be? Bruce McLaren was a driver. He built a pretty good car. I'll just do the same thing, right? Jack Brabham built cars. He was a driver. I'm a driver. I'll do the same thing. And he was so, you know, when I got to meet him again as a youngster, 8, 9, 10 year old, he was the same as, I, you know, they say don't ever, whatever, meet your heroes. Or
yeah,
go to work for them or whatever. There was nothing like that for me. He was just a guy. I was a little kid and he would sit there and talk to me. Hey, you're go-kart racing, right? Yeah. All right. Well, here's some important things. I remember him telling me, here's some important things when you're go-kart racing. I'm like, holy moly, Dan Gurney's going to give me secrets about how to go fast. And he said, make sure you wear good long boots, not tennis shoes. Remember, this is the 60s, and people wore tennis shoes, you know? Yeah. And I'm like, and he's like, because you're going to end up hitting somebody in the back, or they're going to break too soon, and your bumper is going to go under them, and you're going to break your foot, and then you can't race for 3 weeks, and they'll be better than you because they'll have 3 weeks more experience than you. Like, wow. Mom, Dad, can we get some long boots? And they're like, yeah, we'll go do that. It wasn't a new engine, a new gear. It wasn't a new exhaust pipe. It was, let's get some long boots. That'll make me better. And that was the kind of advice that stuck with me. I mean, he got me my first a lot of people would never accept old pictures. Think of helmets that weren't full face helmets.
Yeah.
Like we have now.
Right.
Dan Gurney had the first Bell full face helmet. It was called the Bell Star.
Star. Yeah.
Yep. And he knew I was go-kart racing, and he was the Bell guy before Bell sponsored anybody, but they sponsored Dan. He was whatever. He was like the guy for Bell. And he was, again, on his safety kick with me, Jeff, you need a better helmet, you know, for karting. He says, I wear this full face helmet. I'm like, yeah, those are really cool. He goes, all right. And about 2 weeks later, a little one in size small showed up at our house.
Wait, he just sent you a helmet?
He got Bell to build one and
really?
Send it to me.
You're yeah. kidding.
I had like the third or fourth Bell Star ever.
Wait, how the hell well did you know Dan Gurney that he's just sending you stuff?
I got to hang out with him quite
Jeff,
a bit at races.
This is nuts,
when I was
man.
A little kid. The short story is the Eagle Club had a membership drive.
Yeah.
Who could sign up the most members?
Yeah.
Me and my brother went nuts. We hit everybody even remotely related to us. And the whole neighborhood to sell American, trying to win Formula One, buy a $10 membership and help Americans beat the Europeans in Formula One racing.
Yeah.
And we sold the most memberships. The prize was a trip to the US Grand Prix at Watkins Glen, 1967 or 8.
Okay.
Yep.
So wait, you're how old at this point?
10.
Okay.
Yep.
So 10. So
you, yep, 9, so 10.
The helmet, I'm still just, that's nuts. I mean, right. And that's, so, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So he, and we're talking about that. So I got to meet him, and he was, and as you were saying, in the garage areas at that time, it wasn't like today, you didn't even have to have a special pass. I mean, I'm sitting there on a toolbox or whatever with Dan sitting next to me, and the garages at Watkins Glen, they're the same garages today, actually, up on the hill there. They're the
really?
Exact same garages.
I didn't know that.
And I'm sitting there with his cars right there, and his mechanics are working on it. And we're sitting on the toolbox right on the side of the thing. And if I looked over my shoulder, there's Jim Clark's car, the Lotus, and there's yeah. Colin Chapman working on his thing. And
holy shit.
You know, it was awesome. God. I didn't realize how cool that was then.
Yeah. Because you never do, right? I mean,
no.
It's... And the crazy thing about it, for me, what there are so many people, especially in that golden era, and you know, Gurney was exceptional, but he wasn't unique in his versatility. And in that period, everybody drove everything. You know, there are famously stories of guys jumping out of Formula One cars and getting on planes and then going hop into NASCAR races or going to Indy or running the touring car races immediately before an F1 race, just over and over and over again. Partly yeah. because
you've seen the Jim Clark
yeah.
Formula One and then the support race in a Lotus Cortina on yeah. two wheels or whatever,
right? Yeah. And this is partly because there was very little money in the sport and partly because they just loved it. And it was, there weren't exclusivity deals by and large. And it was just, it was something you could do and something they did. And Gurney did that. And everything he jumped into, he was quick. And, the culture, everything that the dude represented, it was so strong that in the early 60s, Car and Driver famously under David E. Davis, 1964, I think Gurney was like 32 or 33 years old. They spun up a presidential campaign for him that was half a joke and half serious. And the only reason it was half a joke in a lot of ways was because at 32 or 33, you're ineligible for the presidency. You're too young. But the fact they printed up stickers, there were magazine advertisements, there were banners, like this nationwide thing ended up being this weird little cultural movement, not because of his politics or because the way the guy, you know, would have run a country or anybody cared about that, but just because of the kind of person he was. And that whole, right. You know, what my friend Jacques Driessang, who's an AAR historian, you know, spent a lot of time researching the culture of AAR and the cars and knows a great deal about it. You know, one of the things he said about it was, you know, the guy was just as soon shake your hand as buy the kid who mowed his lawn a bike, right? Like, just here, take this. It's the right thing to do. And that's just, there's something about that. You don't get that with, you don't get that with a lot of people, right?
It's the way he was with me, and that's what really made me think about racing differently.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't have, it wasn't all about necessarily, you had to be fast, but it wasn't about that fast lap time. It was thinking about, don't get hurt because you're not going to get better if you're broke your ankle because you didn't have long boots.
Yeah.
You know, you wear a good helmet. And he was the kind of guy, like you said, about the buy the kid a bike for mowing your lawn, sent me a helmet. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. And it was, but I don't think it was anything got the feeling that he never went, wow, this is going to be special. I'm going to blow this kid away. I'm really going to make his day. No, he was just like, he needs a helmet.
I think
this guy a helmet.
I think the one thing that stays with me, and you know, like, because we don't necessarily think about people, our memories of people in our heads, whether we met them or not. And I met Dan very, very briefly. I had lunch with him and a handful of other people toward the end of his life. That is the only interaction I've had with him. Although I've since met a good number of people who worked at AAR who all back up every story and every possible, like, was he really that kind of guy? Yes, he was. It's not complicated. That's just who the dude was. But we don't think about people in our heads as a bio. We don't have, you know, I don't think of people I've known that are gone and suddenly have 1,000 words fill my head. It's just a feeling and a vibe. And that kind of approachable guy next door thing was embodied by everything he did and every way he acted. But at the same time, there's that incredible record as a driver, and you think, okay, well, he did that. And then when he retired, he kept going. The shop that he built spat out IndyCar after IndyCar after IndyCar, that at a time when Indy was, you know, basically a semi-annual revolution. Rules were a lot looser. You could do things and change the sport seriously by coming up with better ideas. And that's all they did. And then got into, you know, did more sports car racing, prototype racing. You know, they ran Champ Car in the 90s. And all of that stuff, everything the shop did was that same, well, why not philosophy? We were talking about one of the things. I was looking through your notes. We have a central spreadsheet for notes and podcast things and everything related to It's Not the Car. One of the things that you wrote down about Wicker, which we'll get to in a second, was that you never call it Wicker. You call it Gurney Flap because it came from Dan, right?
So people listening will understand why that burns me to no end. It is not a gurney. I mean, it is not a wicker flap, a wicker bill. It is a gurney flap.
Okay, so explain what it is. I know what it is, but give us the nutshell on what a gurney flap is.
So if you excuse me, if you look at a wing on a modern race car, you'll see at the very top of the wing, there's a little vertical piece that sticks like straight up.
It's like a little fence, right?
Like a fence.
Yeah.
Like a spoiler. Like a spoiler on a NASCAR car. You know, it sticks straight up. It's on the top of the very top of the wing, usually on the flap. The adjustable flap part of the wing.
Yeah.
Some are tall, some are short. And Dan invented, probably isn't the right word. He was the first to use that device on a race car. I mean, aerodynamics had been around for a long time. You know, Jim Hall, that whole era when people started putting wings on cars. But what Dan did, and there's lots of stories, and I was not involved in this, so all I know is what I've read, and some people out there are going to know a lot more about this than me, but the short story is they're running around Indy, and for some reason, I don't know why, he decides that they should put a spoiler on the back of the wing.
Yeah.
And so he gets, again, probably embellished story, but he gets a piece of a straight aluminum out, he puts it on the edge of the trailer, and he takes a hammer and he forms it into a right angle, and he hands it to the mechanic and says, rivet this to the top of the wing. And they do it. Bobby Unser goes out and goes some ridiculous 8 miles an hour at Indy faster when they're struggling for a half a mile an hour.
So
the car makes so much downforce. It's unbelievable.
So that's, can I add some details? I am a dork who has this stuff at the top of my head because I am a dork. But
okay.
You're right, right? So, but before we get into this, before we add the details, I want to know, so what does that effectively do from an aerodynamic standpoint? What does that do to the wing?
It's really simple. So wing works because the shape of it speeds the air up. We're talking a wing on a race car now.
Sure.
On an airplane, just flip it over. Take everything I'm going to say and it's the other way.
Yeah.
But on a race car, the shape of the wing is such that it speeds the air up underneath the surface of the wing and slows the air down on top of it. So slow air is high pressure. Fast air is low pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So there's high pressure on top of the wing. There's low pressure under the wing. So it pushes, the air pushes down because there's a lot of air, high pressure on top. Not much air on the bottom, pushes down. The more you can speed the air up underneath it, the more low pressure you have, the more downforce you get. The gurney flap makes a low pressure area right behind it. Just like your minivan, when you drive down the road, your SUV, all the dust collects on the rear window because there's a low pressure there. The dust gets sucked into that low pressure. So this gurney flap creates a low pressure behind the wing, which makes the air coming under the wing try to fill that void. So it sucks it into that low pressure, making it go faster across the bottom of the wing, making it make more low pressure and more downforce. So it just energizes the wing and makes it the wing make more downforce.
Which is kind of amazing when you think about the fact that, you know, so this was 1971, right? Bobby Unser was driving for him. He, at that point, by the early 70s, humanity had been screwing around with airfoils to generate lift for 75 years, effectively, right? Longer than that, if you count all the times we didn't really make it work.
Right.
But, you know, the Wright brothers were essentially, you know, 60 years before. And at that point, you know, there were, like, we have analyzed and pulled apart and kind of, you know, dissected, FEA'd on a certain level, the idea of wing as a species so hard and so far that, you know, like by the 30s and 40s, NACA, the predecessor government agency to NASA, was coming up with, you know, there were types of airfoils that they had registered, figured out that would work. You just, you know, in a lot of ways, if you're building an airplane, you went down the line and you pulled one out of a book and you're like, yes, we use this type of wing. And then at a speedway in the early 70s, a Californian guy in sneakers looks at it and goes, well, what if we put some angle aluminum on it? And why not? And the story, you got most of the story. The story goes that the car they were testing was slower than they wanted, because it always is, right? Yep. And they were frustrated. And he goes, well, you know, maybe this will change something about how the wing works. Does the angle, puts it on there. And Unser goes out and he's driving around and he's slower. And he's slower, like significantly slower. And he comes in and they don't really say much. And Gurney and Bobby talk about it later. And Bobby's like, well, so the car was pushing. Car had gobs of understeer it didn't have before because of all of the new rear grip. They retune the car, get it balanced again. They go to Indy so that was 71. They go to Indy in 72. And it is the single biggest speed gain in the history. Biggest one-year speed gain in the history of the Speedway. It was... God, I have it in my notes here. It was 17 miles an hour.
17
at a time when people were fighting for tenths and hundredths of a mile an hour, right? And that's massive. And, like, you know, you talk to Bobby and you read stuff from Bobby. I met Bobby once and it was was like visiting the circus. But you read his interviews with about the subject, which is like listening to him talk, because the guy was a firecracker. But you know, he talks about how they were like, what do we do? Because this is massive and nobody can know about it. And they just ran away. And he pulled that, you know, out of his nose, basically. It just happened. And it was so effective that it ended up, I mean, it's used on helicopter blades. It's, you know, it made its way back into aviation, and it's called the Gurney flap. And how did, I don't actually know, how did the Wicker Bill name come about? Where did that come from?
I don't know. It's, they started calling that in the Champ Car days.
Okay.
I'm not so sure. I'm making this 100% up.
Do
it's
it.
A conspiracy it's radio. Theory, maybe. Yeah. But maybe when you're racing against Dan Gurney and you put that thing on your car, you don't want to call it. That'd be like calling it the Penske trick if you were Ganassi. He's not going to call anything on his car the Penske trick, right. You know? So maybe they just said, we're not calling it the Gurney flap. We got to race against that dude. We're gonna call it a Wicker Bill or a, I don't know. It wicks the air, I guess,
sure.
Somebody said.
It's interesting the way you described it, because, you know, not being an engineer, but having an interest in engineering, which basically just means I read a lot and then try not to talk about engineering in public because I know I'm going to sound like an idiot. But not being an engineer, you know, everything you just described makes a lot of sense. And it recalls all of the, anytime you look up, and I think it might even be on the wiki page, anytime you look up a picture of how, I was about to call it a wicker. How a gurney flap works, how a gurney flap works on the wing, you know, you can see the negative pressure zone behind the fence, right? You can see the little eddies that they draw, the little waves of pressure moving around the wing. And you look at the fence and it's just like a zone in the back. And you think about how air kind of wants to move and works. And it seems so incredibly simple that the knee jerk is always just, how did we get that long without coming up with it? But that's how inventing and innovation works, right?
Yep. I mean, that's the thing that he, you know, he was always to a fault. A lot of people blamed him for trying stuff, tinkering.
Yeah.
Continuously tinkering. His Formula One car, he would never let it alone. And he would try this. It would be like, after the morning, I'm making this again up, but to prove a point, after the morning warm-up, you'd be like, well, what happens if we would try an aluminum exhaust instead of stainless steel? And he put that on before the race, and the thing would fall off and do, oh, well, that didn't work. And so he got blamed a lot because he was so always thinking and so innovative and trying different things. He never knew when to stop and just like, okay, now we got to go race. He always wanted to try the next best thing. And people were constantly trying to say, Dan, whoa, just that's good, but we'll do that at the next test. Let's not do it now. And so I think he got a reputation a little bit for being hard on cars.
Really?
But it was just because he was always trying new stuff and it was unproven.
Yeah.
And his cars occasionally, more often than others, at times tended to break down.
He
would never let well enough alone, which was cool, right? I mean, that's why we got a lot of new things.
And that's that, I don't know, there's, you know, we've talked before about how people get comfortable creatively from an engineering standpoint, from a social standpoint, right? You know, the idea that we get into patterns and we kind of get muscle memory on how a certain thing in our lives should work. And we just keep rolling with it. And that all the really, really great people that you and I and Ross admire have this remarkable ability to look at these things, look at a complex situation and somehow know kind of what's worth leaving alone and what's worth throwing away and what's worth poking at more. And every moment of Dan's in history, you know, did you ever read the CART white paper from late 70s?
Yes. Yep. I mean, there's another thing, right?
Yeah.
So innovative, the Gurney flap, big innovation.
Yeah.
But yet it wasn't just engineering. The white paper is what, you know, that was his thoughts on it very clearly. And it's created a revolution in IndyCar racing.
Yeah. So the backstory on that is, he, for those of you who don't know, so in the late 70s, road racing in America was not stagnant, but the organization that evolved into IndyCar, Champ Car and IndyCar, and like it was it still called USAC in the late 70s? It was, wasn't it?
I think it was, yeah.
Yeah. So that organization was kind of hidebound and had gotten pretty far up its own navel with how, as racing organizations tend to do, right? The sanctioning bodies tend to do. But it had gotten pretty far up its own navel with how the sport worked, how innovation worked, how Indy was supposed to work, and what people were allowed to do, how they were allowed to run race cars, how they were allowed to run teams, how they were allowed to look at everything. And so Dan, being Dan, goes, well, screw it, and starts talking to people and sits down and writes. I had a paper copy. I think it was Marshall Pruitt or somebody gave it to me. I had a paper copy sitting around for a bit. It looks like a high school book report because it's double-spaced on a typewriter, and it's just very simple, this dissection of everything that should be changed about USAC, about basically IndyCar at the time. And you think, okay, well, cool. He wrote a paper. Great. Who cares? But you go through it and it's not just a dude sitting there going, well, we need to have these kind of corners and circuits should be like this and the races should be this long. It's he sat down and he basically said, look, if we aren't here for a reason, if we aren't taking the edge of the envelope and throwing it into next week, if we aren't concerned about the fact that this needs to be a show, concerned about the fact that the fans come to see something they can't get anywhere else. You know, gladiators wrestling cars that are obviously difficult to handle that they can't do. And if we don't come at it from the standpoint of loving it and wanting it to live, it's going to die. And I don't know about you, but every time I go back and read it, probably every year or three, I've got a copy lying around here somewhere. And every time I read it, every single complaint in there could apply it to hell, any sanctioning body on earth. Yep. So much of what's wrong or right lives in that thing.
Exactly. And I think what was cool about that was, and again, I may be jaded with this, you tell me, Sam, but he had so much respect that all the other car owners that he was competing against at the time in USAC all went, he's right.
Yeah.
We need to do that.
Yeah.
Not unlike Roger Penske when he recently basically took over IndyCar racing about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And a lot of people were like, oh, how's that going to work? He's a competitor in his own series. There's going to be a conflict of interest. And all the other car owners went, nope. If there's one guy we're not worried about that being a problem, it's Roger. You know, it's that kind of respect that Dan had back then. Yeah. People were like, he's right. We're racing against him, but this is best for all of us. And he nailed it in that whole thing.
I guess when you get down to it, you know, the reason the guy dented me was that everything we've been talking about is, and you know, I'm a couple decades younger than you. And I didn't grow up, well, you know, I didn't, when I was in school, when I was in elementary and high school, you know, he was running Toyotas. It was, you know, the GTP cars that he ran that famously, I was reading this the other day, and the record that they set at Daytona held for like 26 years, like up until what, last year, 2 years ago, something like that?
That thing was fast.
It's nuts. Like,
oh yeah,
massively, massively quick cars that are bad, bad, fast. And even in that era, there was some trace back to the stuff you talked about, because the guy just had this element about him that just implied that it was, you know, it wasn't about him. One of the most famous people in American racing, one of the most influential people in motorsport, period. And his entire legacy is the people he surrounded himself with. Yep. We were talking about team building earlier before we started taping, and it's got to be difficult to build that, and it's got to be difficult to maintain it almost even more, right?
But I think, you know, being a race engineer and hanging out with mechanics and being a mechanic back in the day, to work for a guy like that,
yeah.
I don't know a mechanic or an engineer in IMSA today that wouldn't love to work for Dan Gurney and all the things he was trying and wanted to do and the way he tried to push things forward. And, you know, you'd love to work for a guy like that. And so it was probably pretty easy to maintain it at AAR. I mean, you just going to work with Dan Gurney today. I mean, how can that not be cool? Because he would, I guarantee you, and I've never worked there. I got the opportunity to and turned it down.
When was this?
So obviously I'd know Dan from being a little kid and we had kept in touch and I was racing IMSA cars as an engineer. Camel just, Light, it was called at the time.
I love the fact that you met him as a kid and just kept in touch with him. Okay. It's just nuts, Jeff.
It was cool.
Yeah.
I mean, went to a lot of Can-Am races, hung out with Swede Savage when he was racing the Can-Am car, got to know Swede really good. And, you know, I was, again, I say that not like bragging or anything. It was just kind of what we did on.
Yeah.
It was fantastic. I didn't nearly appreciate it enough when I was doing it, but I do now. And I realized that was very, very special. But at one time, Dan, it was when they were running the GTP Toyotas. And so this was
late 80s, early 90s, somewhere around then?
Yes.
Okay.
It was right toward the end. Last year or two, I was running Camel Light. Must have been early 90s.
So those cars were, I mean, there was a period where they were kind of, not dominant, but there was a period where they're still sorting them. There was a period where they were massive overdogs, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And this was then. It might have been already when they were down to just the two Toyotas against each other and nobody else even was, everybody had dropped out by that point.
Yeah.
The cycle of factory prototype racing.
How it works, yeah.
The golden era, there's Jaguar, there's Toyota, there's Nissan, there's Porsche. And then suddenly the Toyota is so dominant that every year one of those falls out and you got, P.J. Jones racing Juan Fangio III.
Two guys on the same Toyotas, team.
And that's the race.
Yeah.
So it might have been at that stage. But anyway,
You said no.
Right, Dan says, come and engineer my car next year. I'd really like to have you do that. I told you, he said, I have some pictures that he had sent me with, one day we'll work together or, whatever. And he said, we can do this. He goes, you never drove for me, but you can, let's work together. You'll be the engineer on one of the Toyotas. Man, I gave that a lot of thought. And I had another good job offer. So it was easier, but I was like, yeah, if I work for him, it's going to be hard. I might view him differently for the rest of my life because you're working, right? And it's intense. And he's like, Jeff, your car's too slow. You got to fix this. And I might be like, oh yeah, but I need this and this. And it would start to be a business thing.
Yeah.
And my thought of him being my lifetime hero might be tainted.
But that's valid, right? It's real. I mean, it's funny how we can get really protective with the stuff that, the ideas that matter something to us, right?
Right.
I mean, that's totally understandable. That's
yeah. So I politely said no. And he understood.
Yeah.
And we were still super friends. I mean, we'd see each other. It reminds me, this was the weirdest thing. And I felt almost embarrassed. We were at Portland. I was running my car. He had the Toyotas. We met each other in the paddock area walking to wherever. And I was like, hey, how's it going? And he's like, yeah, pretty good. He's like, your cars look pretty fast. And I was like, yeah, and I wasn't thinking about this talking to Dan. He was just another engineer guy in the paddock.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, I'm struggling. Portland's got that long straightaway. And man, I don't know. I just put a bigger gurney on the thing and it slowed it down too much. And I thought, whoa, I just said that to the guy that invented this thing. And I felt a little weird at the time.
Yeah.
And he didn't even smile. He's like, yeah, but it just depends. It just depends on the lift to drag ratio and how fast you get through that kink in the back. Maybe it's quicker lap time. And we just talked about it. But it struck me as, this is kind of weird. It's a thing I do all the time. And, I don't know. I'm talking to the guy who invented it. It was strange.
There are so many people, I've met dozens and dozens and dozens of people who've done remarkable things in motorsport or in their lives, in their lives. And it's remarkable how kind of bifurcated they can be in terms of how people look at what they've done. Some are, you know, a lot of drivers are just, you know, they retire and it's, I did that. Now I golf and have a garden and don't really care. And right. Some people want to come back to the fountain as often as they can. And they wish they were younger and they wish they were in the car, not because they want to relive their glory days, but because they can't get enough of it. And then there's a third group of people who just, that was the time. They want to tell stories about it. They love it. They live it. They're sad that it's gone. You can tell. And there's something wrong with that. But that's, they live backward with it. And right. Every ounce of Dan's career was always like, okay, now what's next? And I mean, to the point, you know, the GTP cars, the fact that, you know, he was involved with the AR was, when I found out that AR was the shop that built the Nissan Delta Wing, Ben Bowlby's, you know, famously kind of snout-nosed, long anteater thing that didn't look like yep. It should be quick, but was. It was like, yeah, okay, of course, that came out of AAR. When I found out that AAR was doing, you know, very, very hush-hush, top-secret aerospace work, fabrication work, that made sense. You know, Dan built, I think it was the 90s, he built a motorcycle you could lay down on called the Alligator.
Right.
Because,
right.
Why not, right?
And he always had those ideas. I mean, you know, the white paper thing you talked about.
Yeah.
Again, an idea invention. People ask me at times, you know, hey, if you could do one thing to make racing better in general, racing around the world, what would you do? And I say, I would cut downforce on every race car by at least half.
Yes.
Totally. Take half the downforce away.
Do it. Yes.
Right. And I back that up with Dan's quote one time. Now, this is the guy that invented, loosely, invented massive downforce with the gurney flap. I mean, That's what it added. It added massive amounts of more downforce. So he's responsible, in a way, for the proliferation of downforce in racing. And Dan said, not too many years before he passed away, that he said, driving a racing car at the limit is hard, and it should look that way.
Yes. Yes.
We need to reduce the downforce.
Yeah.
Because when you don't have the downforce, the drivers slide the car, it moves around. When you have downforce, the thing just stuck to the road like a slot car.
Right.
And the fans don't get to see it. You know, you watch a modern Formula One race, those guys are really good drivers, but it's hard to really tell because the cars are so well stuck. You watch a MotoGP race and you can see the driver or rider talent. I mean, They're sideways into the corners, the back end's coming out, the front's tucking under. You can see it. They're no more talented than the Formula One drivers, but we don't get to see it in Formula One. Take half or three quarters of that downforce away, put them on a little tire, make it have way more power than it does grip. And we get to watch the talent.
And that's
what Dan was saying.
Yeah. And that's massive, right? Because athletes are, the thing that makes athletes compelling is that you have, and drivers are definitely athletes, right? But you have a person who has devoted their life, the prime of their life, it in the meat of being young and massively, massively adaptable. They've devoted the prime of their life to being as good as a human can possibly get at something. And maybe they get to the top, Maybe they don't, but they are giving everything they've got for it. And if we have no context for that, if we have nothing to compare that to, it doesn't mean anything. You know, if you look up at an airliner at 40,000, 35,000 feet, you don't care that it's doing hundreds of miles an hour because it looks like it's crawling. But if one goes 5 inches from your nose, you feel it, right?
Right.
The first time I saw IndyCars run trackside at an oval from, you know, basically a couple of feet away from the wall / on the wall, you know, you see them track out within inches of your face, and you see people, you know, you see the person at the wheel fighting visible understeer, visibly loose on exit. Like the car's moving and jinking and shaking in ways that you don't get from the stands and don't get on TV. And then you think about the fact that, you know, what downforce does to a racing car, does to talent. It's, I don't know, I'm rambling now, but the point being the guy saw the bigger picture.
Right.
And it's,
he knew what would make it important. Like the white paper, his little thing about taking downforce away, I think that would be fantastic. And those are the kind of things he thought of. And the last, you know, we talked about all of Dan's inventions and his legacy. It was a big influence on my life and my career in racing, obviously. We just talked about it for a long time. One of the cool things for me is every time I see, you know, I have this thing, I don't go to podiums.
Really?
You know, if that's been my thing, unless we win.
That? Wow.
No, I won't go for a second. I won't go for a third. if we win.
That's kind of great.
If we win, I'll go to the podium and watch my drivers.
Okay. Yeah.
Be there with the crew guys and stuff like that. So on the rare occasion that I get to go to the podium.
Yeah.
And I see, I'll make another exception. If my kid wins and I wasn't involved, I'll still go to the podium. But he has to win, not.
Right.
If Colin's second or third, I don't care.
Your dad.
Be better next week.
Makes sense.
But I go to the podium, and every time I see the spraying champagne celebration,
yeah,
I always remember my hero, Dan Gurney, because he invented
the first guy to do it.
Champagne spraying at Le Mans.
Yeah.
The year. And so I'm like, I can never watch one of those. And I may not have thought about him for 4 months. But boom, I see the spraying champagne and I see that happening. And I'm like, oh yeah, Dan.
And that's
so that's a pretty cool legacy.
That's it, right? You know, he invented that famously. He gave a bunch of interviews over the years talking about it. And that moment was rooted in joy, right? He was the first person to shake up a magnum of champagne and spray it all over everybody on the podium. And before that, everybody had just popped it and drank it and, you know, do, and everybody's right. Happy and fancy. And, you know, the quote he gave was always something like, I don't know, I just won Le Mans. I was really happy. Like, what else would you do? And
right. And
that, the fact that embodied the whole guy's career. I guess it was last summer, there was a big AAR retrospective kind of reunion at Road America during vintage races. Something like 27 or 28 Eagles showed up, all privately owned Indy cars, Formula One cars, things like that. And a bunch of people from AAR, from that shop in Santa Ana, flew in. Namely, Kathy Wieda, who started out as, I believe, his secretary and ended up basically running the shop, which is as Dan Gurney as it gets, right? Well, why not you? You're good enough. Sure, yes. Doesn't matter what you were doing. Were you typing? Who cares? But they all showed
up. Known her for a long time.
Oh, she's amazing. Just this bubbly, wonderful, kind person. But she showed up and everybody all down the line, on down to, I forget his name, a man named Stretch, who was the truck driver for a long time. And they were all, we were talking earlier about culture, and they were all just lovely, wonderful people who were kind and had stories. And all of them echoed everything we've talked about, down to how much he helped them, how much he wanted them to do well, how much he treated them like family. One of the, a friend of mine, a guy named Brad Newman, worked there in the, I believe it was early 90s, late 80s. And, you know, he was telling me a story where he ended up at a bar at some point with Gurney years and years and years after he left. And like, he had just been a dude in the shop. He wasn't anybody special. He was kind of busting tires and doing whatever the hell, you know, kind of the Oompa Loompas at AAR do. And he said that, like, Dan hadn't seen him in years and years and years, and did the thing where he looked over and was like, oh, Brad, hi, and remembered him and immediately lumped into it. And sometimes I forget my dog's name. And I just, that's remarkable. We need to wrap this up, but I got more questions. Yep. Did you ever read anything about the moment canceling engine came up with toward the end? It's like five, 6 years ago?
A little bit. I don't think I ever really understood it.
Same.
But it didn't surprise me. I mean, that's the kind of guy he was, right to his motorcycle, you know, all the stuff we talked about. It was, and I think those are the kind of things that, you know, those are the things that influenced me to want to keep doing it. And one person could do all that stuff. And I've had many other people help me along the way, but Dan, and he never, like took me under his wing and said, okay, I'm going to show you how to do a setup sheet, or I'm going to show you how to set up a car for the short oval at Phoenix.
Yeah.
It wasn't that. It was just a general, the aura of the guy and how he treated me through many, knowing him for many, many years, just had a huge influence. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now without that. But there was no one specific thing. And the cool thing was, there was no agenda for him to do that. He wasn't trying.
Right.
There was no benefit to him.
It did not.
Totally because he wanted to help some kid who was interested in what he was interested in.
Right. That engine, I'm like you, it makes me feel better to know that you didn't understand it. Cause I looked at, there are a couple of not schematics, but you know, x-ray drawings that came out, and it had two crankshafts and they counter rotated and it was four stroke. I think the prototype they built was a four cylinder, but the whole point was to maximize efficiency and smoothness. And I don't remember the reason behind the counter rotating cranks, but the fact that this massively new clean sheet, like why not this, came up in, you know, 2 years before the guy died when he was in his 80s. And, you know, I don't know how much of it he had a hand in directly. It doesn't matter. It was representative of him. And the notion that, you know, I have a dozen stories of it. You probably do too. I guess I'll just close on this. My friend Mark Hoyer is the editor of Cycle World, and he said that Gurney used to show up at their offices. Cycle World's in Orange County, Santa Ana's in Orange County. He had a thing for motorcycles. He would come in, bring a bag of In-N-Out Burger, sit there, put the greasy bag on his desk, and this legend, this hero, this titan of the sport would just sit there, and he only ever wanted to talk about what was happening that was new, what was going on that Mark was interested in that hadn't happened before. And you combine that with the selflessness and the notion that it's never, ever about you, and the notion that you're looking forward by also having always one foot in the past. That stuff hit me, and it was part of the person I wanted to be, the person I still want to be, all of it.
A lot of people are lucky to have known him.
Yeah.
And I'll include myself at one of the luckiest.
That's so cool. Well, I think on that note, we should end it. So again, this was how I got here, which is just a look at the stuff that bends or breaks us and makes us who we are. But thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Have fun.